Our session today features a paper from David Weimer of the Campus Christian Ministry in Logan, Utah. The paper is entitled The Thinking Person's Spiritual Connection. The Reverend David Weimer is a United Presbyterian minister, graduate of San Francisco Theological Seminary, and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. He also holds a Master's of Fine Arts in Theater from Utah State, and is currently the campus minister at Utah State University in Logan. And he informs me that the campus Christian ministry is an interdenominational ecumenical organization supported by 7 different religious denominations. Our commentator today is Dr. Thomas Rogers, the chair of Asian and Slavic Studies department at BYU. Tom Rogers is probably best known for his activities as a playwright. Many of you are familiar with his play, Huebner, which was produced about 3 years ago, as I recall. I'm going to turn the time over to David now. Can everybody hear in the back, by the way? I understand that. I hate to feel like I'm shouting, but...
Shout,
okay. I'm going to turn the time over to David, and then after that, Tom will follow with his comments. At the conclusion of his comments, then we will open whatever time is left for you in the audience to respond with questions or comments on your own. So, without further ado, then, Reverend David Weimer.
How are you all doing?
Shout.
You enjoying this theologizing that we're doing this weekend? I want you to know, if anybody finds my comments rather far out or racy, you should bear in mind the fact that I didn't realize until yesterday that this was a Sunstone magazine symposium. I thought it was a Rolling Stone magazine symposium. I am informed by several of my Mormon bishop friends, though, that there's essentially little difference. The big hit for me today was to see somebody from BYU wearing a beard. Anyway, I do want to make one or two comments before I get into the actual text of my address. First of all, this is not really directed to the LDS milieu or situation. I do feel that it is applicable, however. Many of us Gentiles have heard over and over and over again, and I'm sure you've heard the same thing, that the Mormon experience, that the Mormon pioneers and their ancestors today have always had a special place in their heart for the arts, which is what I'm speaking about this morning. However, I think that this is the same kind of situation that you find in the Protestant and Catholic and, if I would say, Jewish situations, in that it is more of an actual lip service kind of thing than a real commitment to the arts and the depths and breadths that they go to. I also make several references to seminaries, and I simply want to point out that my references to the full-fledged graduate schools of higher learning and theological disciplines and all that stuff that Protestants and Catholics know about, not the corner institutions that the LDS attend. Implicit in my title, The Thinking Person's Spiritual Connection, is the suggestion that some religious people do not think. Now, harsh as it may seem, I feel that this is a valid observation. Some contemporary fundamentalists might be terribly offended by the notion, but others might even agree with the idea, since they are so vocal about their disrespect for the intellectual approach to the Christian faith. I think this would also apply to many LDS leaders, if not their followers as well. We are surrounded these days by these conservative Christians who beam with joy and earthly pride at having helped to unseat liberal senators and congressmen, as well as having contributed to noticeable conservative movements in mainline denominations. There are significant numbers of us, believe it or not, who still find all of this quite distasteful. We are a faithful remnant that remains convinced that one of God's greatest gifts to mankind is our ability to think and to reason. However, if we truly want to rekindle the intellectual pursuit of theology, we need to learn some things from the Christian right, for Reverend Falwell and his friends are meeting some needs, providing some dimensions that we are not. Now, one such dimension, I feel, is that of spirituality. This is a serious matter, for it is hard to conceive of a religion that does not have a well-defined sense of the spirit. Religion is essentially a spiritual enterprise. The word spirit appears some 253 times in the New Testament alone, and most of the world's major religions speak to this dimension in one form or another. However, ever since the Dark Ages, the intellectuals of Christianity and other traditions have felt uncomfortable with any sort of metaphysical concern. These religious liberals have maintained that if such a realm does exist, it is not available to us, and that it is better to be concerned with this world and its great needs. Now, I share this apprehension, and yet I feel that my liberal or radical faith is just as sacred and spiritual as Billy Graham's. Besides, human beings have always demonstrated a need to relate to themselves, their fellow humans, and their God in a way that transcends the physical dimension. As Teilhard de Chardin put it, we need to open ourselves up to the divine milieu that transcends the physical. The thinking Christian, I think, desperately needs a connection to a valid spiritual experience. Now, my suggestion is not a new one, but it is one that has never been fully heard, I feel. I feel that thinking people and the mainline congregations need to be seriously involved in the arts or the humanities. Most of us are aware of the great interrelationship theology and the arts have enjoyed throughout history, but there has never really been a widespread appreciation of the arts in our churches. In order to recapture our lost sense of spirituality, we need to wrestle with the unleashed spirit of the artist, the poet, the playwright, and the composer. We need to struggle with the tragedies of the ancients, for their struggles are our struggles. We need to gaze into the world of Da Vinci, Van Gogh, Jackson Pollock, and others. We need to rediscover the morality play and to once again delight in the court jester. We can learn much from taking a hard, cold look at ourselves through the eyes of Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, and the great father of modern drama, Heinrich Ibsen. We need to feel the great pain of loneliness as we wait for God with Samuel Beckett, and contemplate the nature of hell with Jean-Paul Sartre. We should go back to Methuselah with George Bernard Shaw to help us understand our very nature, and we should attempt to understand why my favorite genius, Mark Twain, had both a strong love and a strong hate for Christianity. We need to dance once again before the Lord with a Sunday morning as well as a Saturday night fever. Bernard Scott put it this way: might it not very well be that God under the arts, or that under God the arts, whether they understand it this way or not, are the spiritual alarm clocks for our day, to shake us up and bring us into focus, to check the phony tendencies of the heart, chill us with irony and wash us with beauty and preserve us in a selfhood that many things in our culture conspire to destroy. The arts are full of bad theology, but they also give us the stumbling truth that the human heart is not filled easily. They have the virtue of being alive and the grace to wonder out loud. I see the arts rushing into our vacuum, claiming for itself a priestcraft it cannot perform, but also cannot forever wait for from us. End of quote. Unfortunately, there has been more lip service than actual artistic involvement in our churches. Now, why haven't we been able to fully tap this great resource for God? There are many, many reasons, and I only want to mention a number of these reasons this morning. I think it is important to take a close look at some of these barriers to the arts in our theology. And again, I think this is applicable to Protestant, Catholic, Jew, and Mormon, perhaps Buddhists and others as well. One important stumbling block to artistic endeavor in our churches is the difficulty many of our people have with the intellectual approach, as I've mentioned. Anti-intellectualism is at an all-time high, and it has been a constant problem throughout the ages. Limiting the scholarly pursuit of the Bible and Christian truth to the seminary and graduate school. Time and time again, I'm told by pastors and church types that the seminary or seminary graduate should come down from the ivory tower and get with the real challenge in the local church. Have any of you really experienced the challenge in our local churches these days? Granted, the seminary needs the parish, but the parish truly needs the seminary as well. Of course, we have gone to extremes, but I remain convinced that the church needs to find ways of breaking down the barrier of anti-intellectualism. There is so much joy as well as insight for those in the pew to gain from the arts. And I also reject the notion that this is only for a select few, for we can all expand our minds once we have the desire to do so. Now, I am also of the opinion that artistic types have gone too far in insisting upon the fine or serious arts for use in the church. The decade of the 60s saw considerable energy in this area, yet we seem to go the way of academia in overemphasizing highbrow art as the only acceptable or worthwhile form for Christian endeavor. Now, I do not consider my turn on earth or juvenile Christmas pageants to be anywhere near the kind of art I would have in our churches. But there is more to music than Mozart, and there is more to dancing than ballet. We need to be listening to the Beatles as well as to Beethoven, and sensitive to the modern cinema as well as serious drama. I took 2 hours out last night to see a movie while I was in Salt Lake. That's what us Loganites do when we get down here. Get a little breath of fresh air. And sure enough, it was as stimulating, at least, if not more so, than the rest of the input I had yesterday. I went to see The First Monday in October, and I recommend it to you. It's right out of the headlines, and I understand it's a coincidence, but it's hard to believe. Now, here is an interesting notion that I have yet to find someone else who will agree with this. Concomitantly, we have also joined modern psychology in overstating the case for demythologizing romance in human experience. I see the negation of romance as a factor in the incredible rise of divorce in recent years. Now, young lovers and married couples need to realize that there is more to a relationship than candy and flowers. I know. We have a preconceived mythological idea as to what love and romance is all about. But yes, Virginia, there are such things as candlelight and wine, the enchantment of autumn colors, and the warmth of the Christmas season. They're coming out with all kinds of wines now without alcohol. So it's totally right. Bob Lee was talking about it yesterday. Intellectuals both in and out of the church need to recapture the child that is within them, to be open to fantasy and enjoy things purely for their entertainment value. Part of the problem here is the age-old notion that we must somehow separate thought from feeling. We have a formal support group in Logan, and the other members of that group are always taking me to task for being so intellectually inclined, claiming that I need to speak more from my heart and not so much from my head. I have always found this to be a specious notion, and I was grateful to discover some years ago that the celebrated drama critic Eric Bentley had written the definitive discussion on the issue of thought and feeling in his book, The Life of the Drama. Bentley writes, "No subject is more beclouded with prejudice than the subject of thought, intellect, and ideas in drama. The trouble arises from the modern tendency to separate thought and feeling and to want one without the other. After all, in science, it is often imperative to exclude personal feeling and attitude. What is sought is truth in areas outside these. The mistake, surely, is to make of thought and feeling a sort of funicular railway on which one car must go up when the other comes down. That reason can be driven out by passion is well known. Whether it is the normal function of feeling to get rid of thought is quite another matter. A tragedy about the defeat of reason by passion in its protagonist does not itself exemplify the same process, or it would be a bad tragedy. It is Phaedra who loses her reason, not Racine." End of quote. The mind is the only organ of consequence here. What we call the heart in popular parlance is housed in the brain, as is our reason or intellect. We need to quit polarizing these two great realms of human enterprise, whether we are intellectuals fearful of a show of emotion, or pious sentimentalists convinced that nothing of any value can come from seminary professors and their wordy books. Finally, and this is the greatest of my heresies this morning, one of the greatest barriers to a greater participation in the arts by Christians is the notion that somehow worship is not supposed to be entertaining. I have always found this idea quite specious, for I truly believe that worship is entertainment. It is indeed show business. This is not to denigrate the lofty role of entertainment, of worship in Christian. More than a Freudian slip. This is not to denigrate the lofty role of worship in Christian faith, but rather to elevate the nature of entertainment or the arts to its proper level. Theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher noted the similarity between symphony concerts and worship, and we have never really hesitated to use music, although somewhat limited varieties, in making a joyful noise in our worship services over the years. Probably the most heartwarming experience that I've had personally in finding out how valuable the arts are was when I was with the Missouri Repertory Theater several years ago during the summer, and we had an opportunity to perform Michael Christopher's award-winning play, The Shadow Box, about death and dying, hospice, City of Hope in California. It was very, very interesting because most companies, casts and crews, find a certain kind of community forming when they work on a play. But in this particular production, there was a heightened sense of this community that I would call a real sense of spirituality. Perhaps there wasn't a particular theological focus, Christian or otherwise, but it was there. And it was always a joy to perform that play. And it was also very interesting to note that it was a sellout before the middle of the season came upon us. Wonderful play. If you haven't read that one, there's another one I'd recommend to you. But the important point I wish to make here is that whenever you gather a number of people together, for whatever reason, there needs to be a certain degree of style and organization that pleases as well as provokes the minds of those gathered. God deserves our very best, and worship should be a delightful experience as well as inspirational. Church attendance reflects much more than the pastor's ability to cajole his flock to be present. We must meet people's needs, and to have an interesting, well-organized presentation is a need that we have on Saturday night as well as on Sunday morning. This is show business, and there is much the artist can offer us in making our worship services more appealing and more meaningful. We must also go beyond a sense of artistic responsibility in the form of worship and be much more creative and responsible in the content of our worship services as well. True art seeks to be a mirror of life with both its agony and its ecstasy. And no art would be satisfied with the warm bath emptiness that we see in worship today. Let us turn now to some suggestions as to what we might be doing artistically in our churches, in our wards, and in our own personal journeys of faith. By no means do I see worship as the only mode of Christian artistic expression. Indeed, we need to get away from the Sunday morning focus in our various traditions when human living goes on in great need throughout the week. There are other times and other places to expose ourselves to the art of others as well as to expose our art to others. We need to be artists to create. Any of you that have seen the film Why Man Creates, a short Saul Bass production made quite a few years ago for Kaiser Aluminum, says it all as far as I'm concerned. One of my very favorite films. Add that one to your list if you haven't seen it. In my particular profession, the campus ministry, there has been a tradition of openness to innovative forms of religious endeavor. Over the years, campus ministry has been involved in providing education, celebration, and human caring through the form of seminar and retreat, discussion and experimentation, community action, and social celebration. It has been a flexible, mobile ministry that does not compete with a local church, but rather offers an additional array of creative options to the traditional forms of ministry. Now, in my particular case, I am often, I mean almost every day, asked why I chose to obtain an advanced degree in the arts while remaining actively involved in the professional ministry. Well, not only do I see myself in a very conspicuous artistic role as a campus minister, but our open format lends itself to direct involvement with the arts, from organizing theater parties to the scheduling of artists and other creative individuals for discussions and lecture demonstrations. We have scheduled films, dances, concerts, and various other events that attempt to celebrate the business of living and laughing, loving and caring and crying that is indicative of the spirit of the humanities as well as the spirit of Jesus Christ. But we need to do more. This should not remain in the exclusive domain of specialized ministries, for the local church could be doing these things as well. If the 80s are going to be characterized by a radical change in lifestyle due to energy shortages and economic hardships, we need to do a whole lot more than sing hymns and preach sermons. Churches should become active seven-day operations that provide opportunities for learning, experimenting, sharing, and celebration. I am not in a position to alter the direction of a church or a particular denomination, but I can recommend to you all that we might embark on a sort of lifelong Chautauqua, incorporating into our lives some good books, some concerts, plays, movies, and a lively array of artistic endeavors. Then, in turn, these ideas could be turned back into the church for action and reaction. You see, I believe the work of God does not culminate in law and order, not even in ethics. The work of God, I believe, is realized in the creative art of restoring the world to its original wholeness and health. Now, a footnote of sorts. I know that many of you sense an undue degree of optimism in my remarks, and I don't blame you. As Martin Marty noted in a recent Christian Century article, Christian humanism has fallen on hard times. Certainly those of us who measure progress in human terms cannot help but feel totally devastated in national and regional trends regarding the poor, the stewardship of the earth, and other matters. The arts do not seem to be in for good times in the near future either. However, a lovely lady by the name of Marilyn Ferguson has provided us with a ray of hope. Anybody recognize that name? We've got a conspirator here. Concerned with brain-mind studies, Miss Ferguson has written a book that you must all read, if you have not already done so. It is called The Aquarian Conspiracy. Wonderful title. And it promotes the exciting notion that different folks in different walks of life throughout the world are or actually have been thinking in new and exciting ways, and that the ideals of the 60s have disappeared only because they have been entrenched in the actual marketplace and that the fruit of these ideas will soon emerge. The Aquarian conspiracy is must reading for, as I understand the makeup of this crowd, you are all Aquarian conspirators. I know I am one, and I'm proud of it. Perhaps there are other things in your own life, or ways in which you read the newspapers and see things on TV and on the radio, that you can tell in your friends, whatever it is you do throughout the day, that there is a groundswell of change that is also as exciting as other kinds of change are depressing. It is possible. We can recapture a real sense of the spiritual and, as the Gospel of John mandates, worship God in spirit. The arts do not provide the only avenue to a real spiritual connection, but it is a natural element of the spiritual world that can serve Christian theology well. Of course, the artists need to surrender their distaste for theology as well, for theology is in itself an art. Christianity has a rich legacy of intellectual thought and artistic endeavor. But the greatest of intellectual activity is to realize the depth of our emotions and our capacity to care for ourselves and our fellow human beings. In his novel, The Eighth Day, Thornton Wilder writes, "Nature never sleeps. The process of life never stands still. The creation has not come to an end." And this will deal with the discussion of last hour. The Bible says that God created man on the sixth day and rested, but each of those days was many millions of years long. The day of rest must have been a short one. Man is not an end, but a beginning. We are at the beginning of the second week. We are children of the eighth day. Mind and spirit will be the next climate of the human. The race is undergoing its education. Now, how does Thornton Wilder define education? He says it is the bridge man crosses from the self-enclosed, self-favoring life into a consciousness of the entire community of mankind. Education is the bridge man crosses from the self-enclosed, self-favoring life into a consciousness of the entire community of mankind. If Wilder is right, think of the possibilities for Christianity. If Wilder is right and the race is undergoing its education, the curriculum, I believe, will be theology coupled with the arts. Thank you.
Before I turn the time over to Tom Rogers, I was supposed to make an announcement, which I forgot, and I'll do it now. In the session at 1 o'clock in room 110, the paper by Cynthia Skousen Ellswood is really titled "An Exploration of the Essential Nature of God the Mother." So if you'll make note of that, that may be information you would like to receive. Now, Tom Rogers.
Forgive my reading, my critique of this paper. I do not presume to address the many points which it did. I would like instead to relate Reverend Wiemer's stimulating remarks to the state of particularly Mormon letters. What I say about writing is also undoubtedly true of the other arts as well. Although it seems to me that unlike the Christian intellectuals, who Reverend Wiemer indicates were ever since the Dark Ages wary of any sort of metaphysical concern, this is hardly true of even the most liberal Mormon thinker. The most freewheeling among us tend, in fact, to be among the most mantically disposed, or else they renounce their faith and leave the fold. Personally, I find that as it should be. As for anti-intellectualism and puerile artistic taste, what Reverend Weimer says about the churches of his acquaintance aptly enough fits the mainstream Mormon. In this I take some slight comfort. Satisfaction with the commercially popular, superficial, and mediocre is not a distinctively Mormon trait. And with Reverend Weimer, I reject the notion that serious art is not or could not somehow be accessible to the greater number, though in fact it is not. Back to literature. Why have the Catholic and especially Jewish writers been on the whole so much more successful than Protestants or Mormons? I recently read an excerpt from Philip Roth's Zuckerman Unbound, a telling title alluding to the obverse in its hero of Prometheus bound by Zeus, and thought how well the same situation would fit the plight of a deeply disenchanted or Jack Mormon, and in doing so would also elucidate the nostalgic values of his parent faith. Zuckerman's, and I assume Roth's, attitude toward Orthodox Judaism did not strike me as at all derisive, despite the hero's inability to believe or live up to it. I think it's largely a question of literacy. The American Jewish population numbers not many million more than the Mormon, yet fairly dominates our nation's publishing industry. Jews are, on the whole, that much more sophisticated, cosmopolitan, and well-read. Their writers have a more viable readership within the fold and also more universal artistic appeal. The Catholics are in turn so numerous as to have produced a sizable intellectual elite. They also better tolerate, or at least we do, the idiosyncratic departures from a strictly doctrinaire viewpoint of such Catholic writers as Graham Greene and Flannery O'Connor. The neglect and misunderstanding which Mormon writers suffer is not so much official, as with Michelangelo and certain popes, but in its effects just as severe. Nor would I attempt an analogy with the very greatest Russian lyric poets during the last two centuries, beginning with Pushkin and Lermontov, and ending with Bloch, Yesenin, Mayakovsky, Tsvetaeva, Mandelstam, Akhmatov, and Pasternak, because each of them was either physically liquidated by the regime, whether Tsarist or Soviet, it was the same, or in some way silenced, while the nation learned their verse by heart and never ceased adoring them. Instead, the serious Mormon writer only meets with general indifference and, in some instances, the ignorant suspicion and disdain of his rank-and-file brothers and sisters, despite the fact that they have rarely bothered to read what he has written. I think of shelving that taboo book, Children of God, when, as a student at East High, I worked certain nights at the Salt Lake Public Library. I'd been led to fear its desecration of the church, never knowing until many years later that it was and still is our finest epic narrative about the origins of the church and the early Utah period, serialized in the Reader's Digest, the basis of the film Brigham Young, and the stimulus for dozens of conversions, including that of Grace Arrington and consequently her husband Leonard. I think of the ostracism endured for the rest of her life, was it in St. George, by Maureen Whipple for Giant Joshua, another edifying saga of the sacrifices wrought by polygamous wives for their faith, and that of Juanita Brooks. I think of the panel of Mormon authors at the recent Rocky Mountain Writers Conference who could only talk about what to do and what not to do to be accepted by Deseret Book. I think that those of our writers who are truly questing, as all artists legitimately must, instead of calculatedly illustrating some party line, walk a tightrope They are terribly naive and more amazed than anyone when their work meets with anger and displeasure. But such a reception before too long easily induces a paralysis of the will, so that soon enough the writer wearies of offending other good people. I think that many of us alternate between these moods, confident assertion and cowed capitulation. When we venture, we risk paying a too high price, and we begin to question if our art is really worth it. And maybe it really isn't, especially if our gift is only second rate. But how can we ever know without testing it? And just how much of such thinking is paranoia, which further exacerbates our discomfort and our sense of alienation? Someone will yet have both, someone will yet have both the fortitude and the necessary talent and be claimed by his own a century later, after first being acknowledged by others. I wish him or her well. I do not particularly envy whoever he or she may be. Reverend Weimer devotes the second half of his paper to the notion that worship is show business. I heard the two dialogue editors, Gene England and Robert Rees, debate this one a couple of years ago. I don't think it's such a simple issue, and I believe that art, viewed as a surrogate form of worship, as a substitute for or even an enhancement of sacraments and plain preaching, is fraught with all kinds of dangers. Though I appreciate the spirit of Reverend Weimer's recommendations, particularly insofar as the quality of so many of our church talks and sermons are compared at all levels, Maslow recognized that both religious and aesthetic stimuli produce so-called peak experiences with a similar kind of emotional response. But only one of them can give us reliable and ultimate direction, and it does so most didactically, which is anathema to the art and the writing, which means almost as much to a number of us. Thank you.
We've got about 10 minutes for questions. Why don't you just direct them to either Reverend Weimer or Dr. Rogers, and then I'll have them respond to them.
Why don't both of you come forward?
I would agree with qualifications.
I guess I would disagree in the sense that, you know, if we're going to talk about spirit, you know, the ruach in the Hebrew, you know, what are we talking about? You know, I mean, we're talking about a Holy Spirit or some other kind of spirit. I mean, spirit, to me, is sort of the same thing. There's a, you know, once more with spirit, give it some spirit, to me is similar to, akin to, the kind of spirit we're talking about here. Do you understand me? Does that make, I mean, I may disagree with that notion, I guess, in that sense. I don't see that we have really cornered the market as to what spirit really means in that sense. But somehow the one thing that makes us unique, it seems, amongst life forms, is that we enjoy things. And it seems to me that, you know, the shorter catechism in tradition is that we should glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Glorifying Him is the penultimate. The ultimate thing is to enjoy Him. And I think that's our best clue that I can find from my experience for really getting into God. Both there's a combination of both the didactic, you know, the learning experience that comes through reading a good play or seeing a good play and gazing at a work of art. But if it isn't enjoyable, if we're not interested in it, if it doesn't give us some degree of pleasure, if I can use that terrible word, it's dehumanized. It's not part of what we seem to be about.
One question, I suppose, is minor.
If I just may add this, this reminds me.
I think that it's not inevitable just because this is a work of art. It's going to, the Holy Ghost is going to be there for me. But I don't exclude the possibility. Let's put it that way. Of course, I don't think that it's inevitable when we go to sacrament meeting either, in all cases. But
I should point out that many, many, I may be the only Protestant or Catholic that would perhaps make this statement, that many Protestants and Catholics would agree with his point, that there is something else to be had and to be held in great respect or whatever, admiration, in worship or in the sacramental activities of worship. And I'm saying no. I'm really a heretic. I'm telling you.
I'm going to call him David. That's better.
That's
isn't it?
My name.
Invokes a pleasure. I'm reminded of a poll I understand that was taken independently of the church, but sponsored by it some years ago to assess the opinions, the attitudes of the American populace regarding religions in general, and then we sneaked in Mormons. And what do you think of them? And the polling results were that of all the denominations, and of course only a third of all Americans had any handle at all on Mormons, was that that what was most distinctive in their mind about our religion is that it requires the most onerous and unpleasant things of you. It's the most demanding. And there was very little pleasure associated with that in their minds.
I think the problem that I always run into, and I think we're running into it here, is that I'm not really speaking for Protestantism or Catholicism, that there are myriads of different theologies and traditions. In other words, the idea that the Holy Spirit comes to us individually.
Do you believe in salvation by grace?
It's certainly Martin Luther, okay, you know, that sure, salvation by grace alone, and that, you know, the priesthood of all believers, which is essential to at least the Reformed tradition, and that, you know, I can relate to God directly, and of course, through the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit, whatever.
You can't do anything to be saved.
That's right, and I don't think that I'm really trying to say that we really need to be saved in the sense we could go on forever here. Part of the problem there is you're talking about, if I can make this quick, the fact that you are some sort of evil, sinful creature in the midst of a very good universe. And that is basically true, I think, for the history of Christianity, in many instances, that, you know, man is essentially evil and that he has to be justified to the universe. And I think my premise, which I think is shared by many liberals, is it's the other way around. That I'm a pretty good guy, and what I need justified to me is this world that I live in, which is very painful and very much anti-human. Paul Tillich talks about the man being un at home in the universe, and I am un at home in the universe, and I don't have a real strong sense. I mean, I believe I can error and I do bad things, and especially those people that know me well will agree with that, you know. But on the other hand, I really do feel that my biggest spiritual struggle is to help me understand this world, which is so, I can't relate to it, and I need something to help me do that. And the arts can help me understand that, but it's also part of the theological process, because God is in me.
Your own women deny teaching original sin. You say man is still human. That's more of a theology. But that's not right. That's radical. That's unchristian.
Well, I didn't say that I wasn't radical. Yeah, no, I don't know that I believe in original sin. No, I think man is amoral. There are reams of, you know, God is dead was mild. I mean, there are lots of radical statements that can be made, and it's a tradition that has been lost and maybe never was in Utah. I don't know, but yes, you're hearing me, and you don't have to agree with me. But.
Is there a possibility that the hierarchy at some point would stop equating aesthetics with didacticism in the Mormon Church? And what are the possibilities there? Yeah, that reminds me of the many, many people every year who ask me when we're going to have missionaries in the Soviet Union. I never try to speculate on that. And, you know, that would be very, very fine, but I don't expect it necessarily.
Yes, I didn't mean that it would exclude the other, but I think we are also very mystical, many of us, and there might be some notable exceptions here and there.
That's a very good word, by the way. Mysticism, I think, has an awful lot of what we're talking about here.
Yes.
I'm sure if you have additional questions or comments that both these gentlemen will be around for a few minutes if you'd like to talk to them.